Hi, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And on today's episode, I'm really thrilled to have guest Zach Howard with us today. And for those of you who don't know, Zach runs the Xenopus Archives site. And he is the world's number one authority on the original D&D basic set. And it's the set that I started playing D&D with. Came out in 1977, just 3 years after D&D was invented. Zach, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So when we talk about the basic set here, we're talking about the original, sort of blue box basic set, right, as edited by J. Eric Holmes, correct?
Yes, and I've got it here on my shirt.
Excellent. All right. That's great. I think I might even have sitting on the shelf right
yes,
there.
Yes, I have a few copies over here.
That's great. So I know we were going to discuss. I think the what we really wanted to focus on was the sample adventure included in that text. Is that correct, Dan?
Paul, I'm sorry because I'm actually hearing two audio tracks at the moment. I'm hearing the current one and one from about 10 seconds back.
That's unusual. I would recommend and maybe try refreshing your browser page.
Yeah, I just did. I'll do it again.
All right, we may lose Dan for a second. Apologies, everyone. So Zach, you have a publication on DM's Guild, right? That is an adaptation of that adventure to 5th edition. I think Dan was showing that to me.
Yes, it's a 5th edition conversion of the sample dungeon from the Holmes Basic Rulebook. So that was basically the first introductory adventure that TSR published. And so I just took it and converted it to 5th edition, but I also expanded the material that was included to sort of give more value for the people that were buying the conversion.
Awesome. Very cool. So what led you to that? Why do that?
Well, There's a lot of these 5th edition conversions that they've opened it up, and especially what really triggered it was the recent adventure that they published, a hardback, Ghosts of Saltmarsh, included on the map Tower of Xenopus as an adventure site.
Oh, interesting.
And they had a few paragraphs in the text that described it, and they basically took the original background, it slightly, and included that in there. So it was pretty clear that you could use the original dungeon as this adventure site, as long as it was converted. So that's what really triggered me to start working on it, and it took me longer than I thought to get it done, but because the Ghosts of Saltmarsh came out last year, middle of the year at some point, at my conversion up in January. Some of that was trying to make sure I had all of the 5th edition rules, because I'm far from an expert on 5th edition. Right. I had a friend of mine who served as an editor. He also is more adept with the 5th edition rules. So he took a look at all that and made sure I was doing everything correctly.
Awesome. Have you gotten a chance to run it as that 5th edition? Have you played?
I have not run it as 5th edition. I would like to do that, but I have not run anything in 5th edition. So it would be a learning process for me.
Interesting.
I have played 5th edition games.
Right. Okay, cool.
I've run the original one, many times, but not in 5th edition.
So what is it about the original adventure you think that really sings for you? Like, what I know a lot of folks like just absolutely adore that starting adventure. What is it that?
Yeah, it's there's something about the background that Holmes wrote for it. It's almost like a pastiche of Lovecraft or Clark Ashton Smith. So it's almost like he created like a short story background. Mm-hmm. and then, you know, laid out this dungeon that's interesting without being too complicated, and the specific details, the different rooms are all interesting in and of themselves.
So I grew up using the Moldvay Cook set, so I've only come to this sort of after the fact as an adult looking at it. Mm-hmm. The thing that jumped out to me really about the text of that sample adventure is sort of how much detail is put in the descriptive text blocks in sort of a way to try and guide the reader as to how to run it, like practically run it at the table, which I feel like is missing from a lot of adventures.
Yes. I think Holmes was very aware of that when he was writing it. He had struggled when he encountered the 1974 rules to understand how to use them for combat and to run an adventure. So I think, he was very focused on writing a rule set and including an adventure that would serve for a new dungeon master to run the game for their friends.
Cool. And were you trying in your fifth edition adaptation to evoke that as well? Was that also a concern for you when you were?
Yes. And so one thing I did is I separated out the, in each of the rooms, I separated out the stuff that you could see as, sort of box text, but I did it more like bullet points because I don't like the box text that's really long-winded.
Right. Yep.
Because the original adventure didn't really separate out what you were able to see in the adventure and what was, just the dungeon master.
Yeah, that's really great. Honestly, I think, intro adventures like that, I feel like there are a ton of them, right? But very few of them, I think, really try to guide the DM, especially the new DM, into sort of what does it mean to play and, like, what are the important bits to call out. As someone who's been running the game for decades, reading that Holmes text, I was like, this is great that he's including this, but I don't really need it, right? And so I'm trying to like pick through the giant block of text and say, where are the important bits? So I think it's actually very clever to sort of separate those out and list like bullets of like, here's the important information, and then go into more detail about how to run it. I think that's very clever.
So obviously box text was something that was an idea that was invented post original D&D and post Holmes, obviously. So I agree with Paul. When I saw your fifth edition revision, I was intrigued to see kind of minimalist box text used there. Whereas initially it was all just part of one single mix, as Paul was saying, that you had to kind of disentangle for yourself.
Yes.
So I think that was a smart move.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Zach.
Fifth edition rules, they do include box text in the fifth edition rules. So like in Ghosts of Saltmarsh, they have some separated out. So I was kind of trying to keep things in a format that would be familiar to people reading fifth edition adventures. But I didn't want to write everything out in a paragraph form, especially because, theoretically somebody who's using this conversion is going to have the original one. So I didn't want to just replicate material that was in the original. So I tried to rewrite it in like bullet point format so that you could get the relevant information quickly.
Right. So it's kind of interesting. So if someone does go to DM's Guild and they look up Ruined Tower of Xenopus, or if they just search for Xenopus, that's the thing that's going to pop up for them. It's kind of interesting that you reference and the original product in particular for the map. But it's really convenient that Wizards has had a download of the original product on their website for the last 10 years, and they can just go download that for free. So if anybody does get your product, it's really nice there's that link right there.
Yeah, especially because they haven't released the PDF of the Holmes rulebook for whatever reason, despite they've been selling PDF number of years now. But they did this retrospective on the basic sets like back in about 10 years ago, and they put up a PDF of both the original one and the Menster basic set dungeon from that. So that was they've just left those up. I don't even know if the original column is still available, but the PDFs are still available on their website.
Yeah, I think so.
Get them while they're available.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. It's a nice resource for somebody to take a look at what it looked like originally. One of our commenters is saying that they just ran the original Xenopus adventure to con last year, and you know, coincidentally, I'm actually scheduled to run Friday. So I had a friend that said, I have a bunch of acquaintances who've never played D&D before. Could you introduce them to that? And I was kind of hunting around for what would be the best introductory D&D adventure, in particular for old school stuff. And I was like, I've never seen anything of the right, you know, length and scope of the home Xenopus adventure. So I'm planning to run that this Friday, as a matter of fact.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Yeah.
Is there as so? Okay. So I know that having grown up with this set, right, that this adventure, I'm sure, not only is a great example, teaching tool, well-sized for introducing a new group to D&D, but also probably really pulls on our nostalgia heartstrings. So I'm kind of curious, sure, especially for you guys who grew up with it, is there any way for you to distance yourselves from that and look at it and say, there are improvements to be made here? And I'm especially curious, Zach, did you do any? Did you make any, like, edits where you're like, well, when this bit maybe doesn't run perfectly, let me tinker with it?
Well, what I for the material that was there, I tried to keep it, you know, what was in the original. Mm-hmm. I did try to offer like options for many of the rooms. I have like an optional addition, something that you can expand the room. And a few of them I even included sort of an additional room that could be an additional encounter that could be led to from one of the rooms. So, you know, I tried to, you know, sort of add to some content to the original adventure.
Okay. So are you in those extra encounters, you're talking about specifically the I can't remember how many, but the couple of, I think, E-coded empty rooms?
I'm not sure. I think I mentioned that you could put you could have wandering monsters encountered in the empty rooms. Mm-hmm. That is definitely something that is not, you don't see as much in modern adventures or empty rooms.
Yeah, I think it's something Dan and I have discussed quite a bit about, you know, how much those early books recommend including an empty room or some large percentage of empty rooms in your dungeon. And this is, I think, is one of the few examples where we see it actually happening. I don't know, is it a good choice? I'm not certain.
Yeah, I mean, it's. That's definitely a debate to be had, because so, you know, the one argument is why even have the room there if there's nothing in it. But if it plays into the original conceit of having wandering monsters and waste, and if the character spent a lot of time searching for secret doors and trap, and then they're going to spend a lot of time in those empty rooms and encounter more wandering monsters. Hmm. Which will deplete.
So when you run it, Zach, do you dress those rooms up? Do you improv on the fly some little points of interest, or is it just empty room?
No, I would usually just keep them as empty rooms, you know. And I take that back. I have at least one of those rooms where I added a wizard storage room with a whole bunch of bricks in it.
Nice.
So I have done that, yes.
Yeah, because I feel like I've heard that theory a few times, that like one of the nice things about empty rooms, especially in the older modules, is they're room for the DM to express their own whatever, their own, you know, improv something here.
Yes. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Which is nice.
So there's a room in the dungeon. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, if you're the type of DM who likes to, you know, fly by the seat of their pants and add stuff, it's nice to have the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, so there's a room in the dungeon with a giant spider in it, and south of that room is an empty room. So what I've had in there is a room that actually had stuff that Xenopus had stored, lots of, and I kind of took inspiration from the crypt room that has like there's six sarcophagus in that room, and you roll randomly to see which one is open. So I sort of did that in the storage room with crates, and then each of the crates has some kind of strange wizard item. And that's what I've meant to put on my blog for a while, but I haven't. So that's still to be shown to the world.
I tell you, one thing that drives me nuts about that adventure is the letter key. I find it very difficult looking at the map to try and figure out, wait, where's this room? That they're not always alphabetically in order. That throws me.
Yeah, it was just early on in the format of modules, like best practices hadn't been formulated. So.
Right. Right. Well, and I also got the impression that several of those letters were chosen more to be indicative of what was in the room. Like, the empty rooms are room E. There's a room S with stairs in it, right?
And a snake.
Oh, snake? Is that what the S is?
Yeah, the snake's in there, too, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, right. But there's like, a lot of letters in between that are missing.
Right. Yeah, room... and room G is described as gloomy, so there was definitely... Right. He was definitely, like, taking inspiration from what was in the room to assign the letters. And
that's pretty funny.
Right. That, like near the same time, right, the best example of that is Mike Carr's In Search of the Unknown, Module B1, right?
Yes.
The original publication has Roman numerals for a key. Incredibly hard to tell the difference between XIII versus XI versus XIV, right? And then the second edition of that, they switched it out to Arabic numbers, and they were finally like, you know what's really great? Numbers are good for keys. It's a good
thing. Yes.
Yeah. So one of my favorite things on your blog, Zach, which is xenopusarchives.blogspot.com, is you've got the author J. Eric Holmes' original draft of that whole rule book, and you go through page by page and you look at the differences between his draft and what actually got published, which I'm pretty sure we know is now Gary Gygax doing a pretty heavy duty editorial pass there. So I love seeing his original version of this dungeon and the specific changes that Gary Gygax made, which to my mind is one, increasing the monster strength, two, cutting down the treasure to about a quarter of what Holmes started with, and three, adding more empty rooms. Right? If you run the old school one, which one do you run? Do you run Holmes' original draft version, or do you run the published version with more empty rooms and less treasure?
I tend to run the published version. I mean, that's what I'm most familiar with, that version. It would be fun to just stick to the Holmes' original draft, but I usually have the rule book handy, so that's what I. But he definitely had way more treasure in there, so. If you wanted to make sure that your characters were going to level up after that dungeon, then you would definitely want to use the original one.
Right. And I have a running debate with a former guest right at the moment about clearly Holmes was just rolling on those treasure tables that, created thousands and thousands of gold pieces of treasure. And Gygax came through and clearly was like, nope, that's not the right way to use that. Which I think is a really interesting edit on how that was supposed to be used. But one of our prior guests feels rather strongly that I'm wrong about that. Actually,
wrong to do it that way.
Yeah. Well, so, in the original draft, what I'm reading is Holmes said, you got to use those treasure tables and just roll on them. And in his draft, the dungeon, it clearly reflects that. But Gygax came through and cut the numbers down by a whole lot. And he also at two separate places, right? Two separate places in the text, he said, only use those treasure tables for really large monster lairs. Don't use it for normal dungeon stuff. So I feel like that's a pretty indicative sign of that.
Yeah. Though he may, in a lot of hills, there's a lot of treasure. So
true.
I don't know if what Gygax was actually doing when he, I have a feeling he was just making it up on the spot when he wrote his modules, but.
That's a pretty good guess. And I think that it certainly looks like the DM is going to have a massive thumb on the scale about how much stuff is going to be in there. I will say that when I have crunched numbers, he's surprisingly consistent. The numbers of the amount of treasure in his Castle Greyhawk and his B2 and his edit to the Holmes dungeon is actually way more consistent than I would have expected. So maybe there's some kind of intuitive plan that he had behind the scenes, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in terms of the fifth edition adaptation, Zach, I'd love to pick your brain on this because I've written a module for old school called The Vile Crypt of the Reawakened Sisterhood, which I adapted to fifth. We've talked to other guests about that process of writing for old school first and then adapting to fifth. So I'm curious, are there any particular gotchas or areas that you hit in that adaptation that you found particularly difficult or had to do something unusual to bring this content forward, you know, 50 years?
Monster numbers for the encounters. Like I included a wandering monster table. I took the wandering monster table from the original basic set. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of like revised that in this to make it fit with the particular elements of the dungeon. But it's hard to get a handle on using the R. I actually, and Dan will probably like this, I made a little spreadsheet, and I put in all the numbers so I could like see like what the CR would be based on the how many monsters there were, you know, versus like the expected. I think I used a 4-character party. It always seemed to be less monsters than I thought there should be. Like it's,
I've done some when I first started doing fifth edition stuff. I was using D&D Beyond a lot. They have an encounter builder tool, which they think they also by default pick four characters as the basis. And I remember it giving me like very few goblins and thinking, oh well, geez, but there's barely any goblins here. And then very nearly TPKing my whole party with very few goblins.
Yeah. So. And I've had the same reaction, too. And I think it's partly specifically because Gex was upping the monster numbers to in those adventures to possibly unreasonable levels. And one of the things I noticed in your 5th edition version, the monster numbers are about what Holmes had to begin with of maybe, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 goblins or something like that. And I will agree with Paul that when I first used the published version of the Holmes Dungeon, I slaughtered every player that I ever ran through it. I had at least 3 or 4 TPKs one after the other because you had Holmes' advice about how many characters to have, and you had Gygax's number of monsters, which were just going to utterly destroy them every single time. And that was our initial experience of D&D is this game where you go in a dungeon, you get annihilated in about 15 minutes all the time. So I think that Holmes was right, and I think that you're right, Zach, for what you're doing. And I think I've shared the surprise of like, oh, a reasonable balance is actually fewer monsters than I'm used to reading about per Gygax.
Yeah, I mean the prime example of increasing the monster intensity is the spider, which Holmes had at 1 hit dice, and then Gygax changed it to 6 hit dice.
Jeez,
right, right.
I wonder if that's just indicative of who each of them were playing the game with, right? I'm sure Gygax's test group was all like people that have been playing with him for years and years and were just, you know, knew all of his methods and were much more prepared as opposed to, say, Holmes, who I'm thinking is probably playtesting with kids, right? Wasn't that his whole...
Yeah, he did run some games for kids at like his local game shop. So,
And certainly new players. Right? Certainly, a lot of his writing is trying to address brand new players who maybe don't know the tropes and aren't gonna realize when they've gotten themselves in over their heads.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Gygax played a lot with his son Ernie, who I know was after playing for a while, he was a very clever player. Lots of stories.
Yep.
Right. 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 It's an interesting question about like how to introduce people to the game for the very first time and how much information you give them. And I do think that the Xenopus dungeon does a really good job of that. I like that in your fifth edition conversion, you have lots of like literary references, right? Is you have quotes from the original adventure text, you have, you know, pointing out when there were places that were ambiguous and the DM, you know, things like, what do the statues look like, right? And you point out, it doesn't say what the statues look like. You could make it a wizard, you could make it a fighter, presumably it's going to be like normal man-sized, things like that. Did you consider, and then you have a really nice bibliography at the end, right, of like 25 different books that probably fed into Holmes' sensibility for these kinds of things. Yes. Did you consider, now I personally like that, and I like writing that kind of stuff in my works. Did you consider possibly stripping that stuff out for a cleaner experience for 5th edition DMs?
No, not really. Like I actually added that the bibliography towards the end right. of when I was working on it. So, I just would have, I have some trouble making like an executive decision and saying like the statue looks like this, like when it's not described in the original one. But like it's something I've played around with. You know, sometimes when I run it, I have that statue actually be Xenopus himself. But. You know, it's nice to keep the options open.
I like that a lot myself. And it, yeah. So your fifth edition product, it's both an adventure, but it's also a really nice historical look at what the game form looked like. It gives a really good sense about what it's like playing with the original one, and it gives this really nice super set of resources for people to further explore what the pulp background was. So personally, it was like, I haven't seen a product like yours actually, but personally for me, I really, really liked it.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Let me now nitpick a little bit. Not your work, Zach, but I'm going to pick on Holmes a little bit. What is up with those rat tunnels? Why are they there? Like there's all this notes about how you could go exploring through the rat tunnels and you have to crawl and this is how many people fit, but they don't go anywhere. What's the point?
Yeah. Now in Holmes' original version, he had the chance of finding pieces of jewelry so often, and jewelry in the original World of Rules is worth a lot. So there was definitely a reward if you did end up doing that.
Interesting. And Gygax cut that. And then
Yeah, the TSR version, they cut out the chance of they cut out the reference to jewelry there, and it was just a few coins, I believe, that you can find. So there's no real incentive. So
how do you write it? What do you put in the tunnels?
Well, what I've been doing recently, and this is an added encounter for the adventure, is I have there's a larger room with some larger rats in it, and and they have more treasure. So there's something another. Thing I've also in the rumor table I have them connect to a basement in the house in the town.
Well, see that's nice. I like that a lot. That's
sort of the, you know, the traditional D&D, like go in the basement and kill the rats for somebody.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to intro someone to the adventure, I would think too, right? You can do the sort of classic, like go in the basement, kill the rats, and then you could have, you know, I could imagine doing another encounter of like, they keep coming back. Can you find out where these rats are coming from? Like, okay, we're going
to
go.
Yeah. I like the idea of having multiple ways to get into the dungeon so that if a DM was running it in town, he could have the characters hear different rumors and then perhaps come to the dungeon from a different direction. So I think that keeps it interesting.
Nice. The other thing I'll point out is in Holmes' original map for it, the rat tunnels did connect over by the ghoul room. So that did provide possibly an alternative way of maneuvering around the dungeon a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, certainly the map that's in the PDF and in the book, they just go nowhere. Right? They just dwindle out into
true.
The north.
Yeah.
That struck me as really odd when I was reading it. I was like, what? Why? Why would you put this here?
So the characters get hopelessly lost. Gygax actually did that in the village of Hamlet in the moat house. There's like tunnels that just go off the map forever. So he might have been influenced by Holmes. And I think he said if they go off the edge of the map, they're hopelessly lost, so it's like a TPK.
Right. Right. I mean, the other thing is it does provide... Right, it does provide, you know, expansion opportunities for the DM, right? So you have expansion opportunities with the rat tunnels. You have an expansion opportunity with the tunnel off the ghouls under the cemetery. You've got expansion of possibly other pirate caves or islands or something like that. And that was actually Gygax supposedly did have a thesis whereby there should always be something more. You never actually totally get to the end of it all the time.
I feel like there is certainly a trope that we're playing into here, right? Of like, oh, complex, difficult to navigate tunnels where I get lost is a fantasy trope, and it's enjoyable to see in our game. But the actual mechanics of role-playing it out often, I think, leave us disappointed. Dan, I feel like you and I saw this in Rappahannock, right? Where there's, you know, these giant maze, and they give you maps of the maze, and just actually playing out the players trying to draw maps and navigate through this impossible to navigate area is actually not very fun. And I think we both discovered it's much more enjoyable to abstract it a little bit and say, okay, you've entered this area that's very difficult to navigate, you know, make a roll or we'll do something to just sort of highlight that it takes you a long time and is very difficult, but we're not going to make the experience tedious for you, the player.
Yeah, and I think it's funny because just yesterday the map maker Dyson Logo said the same thing, because as an exercise, he drew a whole legal-sized map of twisty little mazy passages, posted it, and specifically said, now to be clear, I would never run this in a game. I would never do this to players. I would abstract it, right, just exactly like you said, Paul. And I also was thinking about the Rappahannock issue that I kind of regretted after the fact. Paul being the guy trying to draw the map.
Well, I mean, to be fair, the text tells you to do it, right? Here you go. Good luck.
Yeah. At least one edition of it. I guess I found an earlier edition where it wasn't that expansive. And I will say, if I was really going to do a maze nowadays, it would be much smaller, about the size of the rat tunnels in Holmes Dungeon. I wouldn't make it any larger than that, honestly.
Yeah. I like the idea of having part of a dungeon that is a maze, and the characters know that there's a maze there, and so then they have to be the ones to choose to go in there. So they're, you know, if they have that expectation that they're going to be doing something out of the ordinary or more difficult, and that they're the ones choosing to do it, I think it might be more acceptable. But it, you know, I see definitely that it could be very tedious to communicate the twisty tunnels and have the map.
I'm sure there's some players out there who freaking love it, right? They get out their graph paper and they're like, all right, go, man, go. But it's not for me.
I always think back to the I played a lot of the text adventure games in the 80s, the Infocom game, especially the original adventure, and Zork they had a maze as a section of the dungeon.
Yep.
And right. But there's something different when you're playing on the computer and you're making the map yourself based on what it says. Those maps were just more like, you know, east, west, north, south, and like you had to figure out like how many times the rooms repeated to figure out how you could get out of there.
Right. We were just talking.
We
were just talking video games last weekend, and I mentioned Zork at one point, and that was totally what was in my head. It was specifically like, that's actually the one part of Zork I actually figured out was the mazy section, that you had to leave markers for yourself. Because the east passages never connected with west passages. It was always some other random connection. And I did enjoy that, but I guess it's you know, it's not for everybody. Maybe it's not for like four or five people at a table.
You know, that I think that's key, right? Like I've had the same issue in my own adventure where I have a handout that needs to be translated, and there's a Rosetta key, sort of Rosetta Stone-esque key, and the player can sit down and take this weird message and translate it, which it can be enjoyable for one person. But when you have a table of five or six people who are all watching that one person do this one thing, you know, the majority of your table is bored.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely experienced that just in playing in games where, like Stonehell, where somebody has to be is mapping, and there's a lot of back and forth with the dungeon master and the person who's mapping, and the other people are just sitting there kind of like watching the map slowly appear.
The original players, right, the original players with Gygax say that was the whole game, and that everybody at the table was over the table sweating bullets that they might make a wrong turn and all die as a result. But it seems like it's surprising to hear that, and it seems like a harder sell. It's really hard to imagine that being the entire game these days.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I actually, as a dungeon master myself, I actually don't mind drawing the dungeon out for the party. I actually do that in con games where we're short on time. I did that last weekend. I helped organize a local convention here, and called ScrumCon.
Awesome.
And I ran a game at it. I ran a sequel. I have a sequel convention game that's like 40 years later in the Xenopus dungeon, and I use elements from Holmes fiction in that. And for that, I got a giant piece of graph paper. Put the I put it in front of me, and I just drew out the map myself.
There are some circles where that would like be taboo and be subject to excommunication, but I think we're all friends here, and I think we would all accept that, and we've all done that at some point.
For sure, for sure. And you know, the interesting thing is, and when we're talking about adapting this older content to 5th edition for the modern player, I feel like the modern 5th edition player is actually more interested in stuff like character play. And that's actually something I would also call out about this adventure, is that there are more than one NPC in here that you can have a social interaction with. And I think that's very clever, right? There's not a ton of stuff from this era that has that many socially interactable NPCs in it.
Yes, yeah. I've been leaning lately towards the evil wizard that's in the dungeon, having him... And, like, I usually just would have him, like, attack or fight, but, like, I think it's more interesting to have him perhaps try to employ the characters.
I mean, that initial point of contact, I think, can be very interesting with the wizard. But I was also thinking of, like, you've got the pirates, and they've got a, you know, they've got a prisoner, right? There's plenty of people to chat with down here.
And Zach, in particular expanded the possible reactions. So you expanded like what the goblins might do and what the wizard might do and what happens to his charmed servant if you happen to free him, which I thought was clever, which I never thought about before. Right. So I think that you did a really good job of actually expanding possible reactions, which are totally missing, you know, totally not in the original product, but really very appropriate for 5th edition.
Yeah, and some of this comes from having thought about the dungeon for so many years. You know, you're suddenly like, oh, well, why not have this person do this or whatever? And I'm still always hearing new ideas.
How much of that stuff has come like in the middle of play? Because like a lot of times something happens when I'm playing and it something pops out of my head and I was like, that's pretty clever, and I never would have thought of that in like an entire year sitting at my desk at home.
Yeah, I can't think of any particular examples right at this moment, but that's definitely the kind of thing that the players will always surprise you too with what they do.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's the joy of DMing, I think, is watching the players do something bizarre that you never expected.
Yeah, and that happened in the con game. The con game that I was running last weekend, that and I don't want to give away any spoilers for that adventure yet, because it'll be, but I'm still running it at conventions, and I don't want to give away any spoilers. So, but the players surprised me.
Yeah, that's great.
Great. How many times did you playtest specifically your 5th edition version of Xenopus before publishing it? Like maybe none? Paul, I don't know.
No. Yeah, I answered that. Paul asked me that earlier. Yeah. I didn't. I have not run it in 5th edition. No. I have not run anything in 5th edition myself, so that is why I had somebody check over the 5th edition stats.
Okay.
Another thing I found very challenging about 5th edition was creating regenerated characters. There are so many, you know, I's to dot and T's to cross when you're making the characters that it is challenging.
Yeah, I mean, that's,
one is hard enough.
I think that's generally true of 5th edition, right? Especially when you're adapting old stuff to 5th edition, is that it takes a lot more text, right? Like from the characters to the monsters, right? Your monster stat blocks get quite long. I found that that's an interesting challenge, especially if you actually are worried about your page count to deal with that.
Yeah, I managed to cram four pregens into one page. And that was the challenge in and of itself.
Right.
All right, I'm going to try something weird here and see if I can send a piece of chat. Here you go. So William has a question of how strong is the demand for the old school content in the 5e DM Guild world?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know how to answer that particularly myself, because there are a lot of conversions there, so I would say the demand is pretty high. So some of the conversions are very rudimentary. They just ruin, like, have the stat blocks basically converted, and maybe a few of the, like, traps and stuff. But some of them, I tried to make mine more extensive, you know, to provide more content.
Yeah.
There's a whole series of that one group has been doing of conversions that all look very similar to each other. They have nice covers.
I mean, certainly it seems to me that that's, like, a lot of the official content in DM's Guild is adaptations. In fact, my own 5th edition group right now is running a 5th edition adaptation of the G-series. So I think it's pretty popular, honestly. I think that's, you know, good writing is good writing, right? So why not adapt it?
Is that something that Wizards put out themselves, or is that just a conversion of the original?
That's an excellent question. I don't, unfortunately, know the answer to that. I am a player in that particular game, so I've avoided going to look. I already know way too much about the G-series, so I'm trying to, you know, preserve whatever surprises I can.
It's interesting because I spent time converting it in 3rd edition, actually. So, like if someone searched for 3rd edition conversion of that stuff, like it possibly has my name on it online. But I haven't done 5th edition conversions myself. But the overall work effort looks about the same.
Yes. So Wizards has converted a lot of the modules pretty directly themselves. In the Ghosts of Saltmarsh, the U series is all in there, and it's converted, and it's a pretty straight adaptation. They tend to cut out lots of the treasure because the 5th edition characters don't need as much treasure. They don't need it to level up. They don't magic items because they have more powers. So I use that kind of as a guide when I was converting as well. A lot of the treasures I cut by down to 10% of what they were in the original. My editor, he advised me to reduce some of the magic items. So I tried to get creative with that. I think at least one of them I made like a much weaker version. Instead of having just a sword plus one, I have it as a sword plus one only against rats.
I saw that. Yeah. And the other thing that you did is you made that was smart. I mean, and it was both in line with the Holmes rule book is that you committed to stuff that was just in the free Wizards D&D Basic product. So yes. The D&D Basic that you can just download for free, you made it so that that's all you need to run this particular adventure. So once again, it's a really great intro point. If someone wants to run D&D for the first time ever, they can get that free version of the rules and use this product, and it's a perfect match.
Yeah, that was a bit challenging because some of the stuff you would think would be in like the basic rules, like gelatinous cubes, are not there. That actually inspired me to make a my own version of a gelatinous cube that was that's like slightly weaker and is was bred by Xenopus to clean the dungeons. So the challenge of trying to use the basic rules actually inspired me creatively in several ways. I also, in a few places, I ended up changing what Holmes had originally if you're just using the basic rules. And then I also referenced the more expanded 5th edition rules if you are using those.
Right.
I think it's really surprising to look at those basic rules and realize how many things that we're so used to are actually missing. It's definitely certainly a very playable game as printed, but it's odd. You assume that like it's the core, but it's not really the core, right? It's like an odd vertical slice of the game.
I don't know what decisions went into them, what they chose. I mean, they obviously thought some about what they wanted to put in it and make it available versus like trying to leave enough in the full rules so people would be incentivized to buy those.
Right. Like I know Dan and I were talking about spells recently and we're surprised to discover that polymorph's not in there. And frankly, when I look at it, if you're going to make a wizard character, hope you like evocation, because that's the only class that's in there, the only school specialization that's in there.
Right.
So, yeah, good I think point. It is. You have to take into account that the basic rules are as much a marketing gimmick as they they are an attempt to introduce more people to the game.
Yeah. The amount of content that in them is large. So
That's true.
They did a good job in that respect. Like, not just a little tiny slice of the rules. I mean, there's more material overall than the original basics included. It's not just limited to three levels. And so,
yeah, that's got to be, challenge, I think, to stick yourself to those rules. Cause I've looked at them occasionally and I've thought about running stuff with just the basic rules. And specifically when I was trying to do stuff where I wanted a more old school feel, so I only wanted like the four core classes, the four core races. But the problem is there's so much other stuff missing. I end up saying, well, it's easier to just take the player's handbook and say, just these races, just these classes, done, than to try and use the basic rules and jimmy it into place.
Yeah, I'm not jimmy people are using just the basic rules. I haven't seen any other products that were written just for the basic rules. There are don't seem to be communities of people that are like on Facebook or other social media of people just using the basic rules. So
it's an interesting contrast because when you look at the Dragon magazines from, so obviously original D&D 1974, and then in 1977 you had Holmes edited basic set. At the same time, when Gygax was working on the Master Advanced D&D line, and the Advanced Monster Manual came out the same year as the Home Basic set. And you can see Gygax's enormous surprise that it was the basic set that exploded in popularity, and they were shipping millions and millions of these basic sets out. And he was there's at least one article where he expresses just astonishment that his magnum opus of advanced D&D wasn't the thing that exploded, and instead they had to pivot and publish a whole bunch of basic sets because they were running out of product and dice. For those of us that played with the chits that came with it at one point. And so it was, in some ways, it was the Holmes basic set that really set the tone for D&D being a real cultural event. And it's interesting that there isn't the need for a basic set the same way there was at the time.
Yeah. Well, that's possible. On the other hand, they do sell that starter set, and now there's an essential set, and those seem to be pretty popular, at least for limited, you know, to start out to get into the game.
Right. And that's you know, if you go to your local Target, that's what you're going to find on the shelves, right, are those two box sets.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, it's weird how there's all these, you know, there's the starter set, the essential set, then they have the separate free basic rules online. And there's also SD, which I can't recall now if it's exactly the same as what's in the basic rules. So there's a lot of different moving parts out there.
Interesting. That's good to know. It's handy to be able to walk, like if you're an aunt or a parent, it's handy to be able to walk into a hobby, you know, a toy store, and have a box with the brand and give that as a gift. And it's a nice package to help someone get into the game. So that does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think that's key. I mean, they definitely have the essential set for sale at Target these days, which I think was how it was during the height of the original basic set. I mean, all three of the original basic sets to have them at toy stores.
Exactly. So it sounds like, you said that you have not run a fifth edition game. Is that to date? Is that right?
That is correct. I've played in some, but I have not run any.
And it's that's true for me. I'm in the same boat at the moment. Yeah. So just to be clear, your preferred edition to actually run, I'm assuming, is the Holmes Basic set. Am I right?
Yeah. And original D&D as well for the higher levels.
And okay.
Although I'm a huge fan of first edition advanced D&D as well. When I run, I tend to just use the original rules now because they're a little simpler. You know, when I was a kid, I had the Holmes Basic set, and then pretty quickly went on to Dungeons and Dragons.
I didn't encounter the exact same arc.
I did find the original D&D rules in the later 80s, the white box. I found it at a toy store, and I bought it. And I was kind of underwhelmed because I was expecting it to be more different than what I was used to. I don't think I noticed as much what was missing as seeing what was there, and what was there seemed familiar to me. And so at the time, I was like, oh, original Dungeons & Dragons, it's, you know, it wasn't really that much different than what it may be. But later on, you know, in the past few decades, I came to realize. I was also playing BX in the 80s at the same time I was playing Advanced. I had different characters for each rule set. So also, I was also familiar with those rules. So the original D&D, you know, just reminded me of those, or Advanced D&D in different ways. And
did you have the perception when you were doing that those were actually two different games, that you were playing two different versions of a different game?
I did, but I don't know. Well, at least after the first, year or two, mid-80s, once the Mensa rules were out, it was pretty clear they were two lines.
Right.
I kind of had unusual. My best friend and I, we had trouble finding other players. So what we would do is we would each make a party of characters. Mm-hmm. And then take turns DMing for each other. So I would have my party, and he would DM, and then he would DM, and I would have my party. But at some point, I had a separate party for advancers and for basic expert characters. Yeah. And I would use the module. You know, he would run that module, and I would use those characters.
That's funny. I know when I first got started, I was using the Moldvay basic box set. I don't think I even had, frankly, the expert box set. I had just the basic set, and then the AD&D Player's Handbook. And I don't think I really understood that these were not compatible, or not. I mean, they were compatible, but not. I don't think I realized that they were different games. And I thought I'm clearly just missing the linkage piece that tells me how these all fit together, and I just have to make that up, I guess. And then I think eventually, probably by the time I really was understanding the game more, second edition had come out, and so I was like, well, I'm going to play second because that's new.
And going back to the Holmes basic set, it actually refers you to Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, but the rules do not mesh exactly. So there's a long history of that.
And in the Holmes draft, Holmes didn't expect it to say that. In the Holmes draft, he's constantly referring to original D&D, and then Gygax comes through and snips those out and turns them into Advanced D&D pitches.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely took the easy route of just changing where Holmes wrote original D&D to Advanced D&D without going through and making the rules fully compatible. It would be neat to have a version of the Holmes base set that were completely compatible with Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
That's a good idea.
I thought about doing some reference sheets for that. Combat tables are a little bit trickier because they have Advanced D&D has combat tables for each class, and so you start getting more complex than what you would expect from basic. But I might do that at some point.
That would be nifty.
At one point, I thought of making there's like zero edition would be like hit like a version that was completely compatible with original D&D, like his manuscript. And then so they published three different editions of the Holmes box set. A fourth edition Holmes box set would be completely compatible with Advanced D&D. So you could have your different options depending on what you wanted to move on to.
That would be neat. That would be really neat. Yeah.
So we're running low on time here, so I just want to ask, is anybody any final thoughts here on Holmes Edition D&D or the Tower of Xenopus specifically?
Well, I'd like to ask Zach in particular. So, I mean, so your ruined Tower of Xenopus is a silver seller or a gold seller at this point on DM's Guild?
It just hit Electrum, actually, like a few days ago.
Okay. Congratulations.
Okay. Yeah. So granted that success, do you have any other projects like that on the horizon that you might do in the future?
Well, I have thought about doing, the natural thing would be the second level engine.
Yeah.
Although I would also like to do a version of that for old cities. So my latest maybe is to do an old school D&D, original D&D version of the level of the dungeon, and then publish a conversion for that. So I don't know. The problem is that you can't publish the D&D content outside of DM's Guild. So, but I would have to make the dungeon somewhat generic.
We've talked to I think our friend Ian about this, Ian McGarty, who has published stuff that is both targeting old school in terms of Swords and Wizardry as well as 5th edition, and does that by not putting it on DM Guild but rather by putting it on DriveThruRPG, and I believe you can put 5th edition content on DriveThru provided it's only using the is it still called the SRD? The SRD?
Yes, there's SRD.
So. The Open Gaming License part, right? Anything that's covered by Open Gaming License. So you may have to try a little harder to adapt some of those monsters and, get it working in 5th.
Yeah. Yep.
But it's definitely possible.
I'll look into that.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome.
Cool. Cool. So let me say, so if anybody wants to see Zach's excellent work, number one, where I first discovered your stuff is on your blog at Xenopus Archives, all one word, xenopusarchives.blogspot.com. And if you want to see the new best-selling 5th edition product, go to DM's Guild and look for Ruined Tower of Xenopus, or just Xenopus will find that. And you should do that.
You just search
it's great.
Xenopus on there at all. There, I don't think there's any other Xenopus modules on there right now.
Awesome.
You're right.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Zach. To our viewers, if any of you have further comments or questions about Holmesian D&D or the Ruined Tower of Xenopus, please drop them in the chat. We'd love to hear from you. We'll try to keep the conversation going and get you any information that we may have skimmed over here in the show.
And remember that you can like and follow and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch, all of those sites under the handle Wandering DMs.
Our show is available as an audio-only podcast version, which you can find on our website, wanderingdms.com. It's also redistributed on various podcast carriers, such as iTunes and Google Podcasts. If you are listening to this show in one of those formats, please take a moment to rate and review us. We really appreciate it.
We do. Big thanks to Zach Howard of Xenopus Archives today. And as always, a huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. And if you would like to support them, please, if you'd like to join our supporters, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Don't forget that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. So join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
Well, we'll see you then.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.